the universe speaking to you. You are now tuned into the Modern Spiritual Life Coaching Podcast by the certified master life coach and spiritual guide, Coach Chip. Welcome, souls. We now begin this episode of a transformational journey. Unedited, unscripted, and creating something from nothingness. Now, let there be light on modern spiritual life coaching.
This is the episode 168 on the Modern Spiritual Podcast. In this chapter, we'll discover and uncover the secret to enlightenment with the Buddha meditation. Then we will get into our mini-series of the mystics. Right now, here's your host, Diva, on this morning gratitude of the Modern Spiritual Podcast.
Good morning, I am Diva, and on this episode, we are about to unfold the secrets to enlightenment with Buddhist meditation. Meditation is a mental exercise found in all religions. In many types of meditation, such as prayer or reciting mantras, the goal is to achieve an altered state of consciousness with an intention of connecting with a higher deity. But Buddhist meditation takes a different approach. Buddhism uses meditation as a way to achieve enlightenment. Instead of seeking a connection with a deity or seeking the cause of what is, Buddhists approach the human condition in a straightforward way based on observation. Most of life is defined by pain and suffering. Those, unfortunately, are the driving forces behind much of what we do to avoiding pain and suffering, and willingly or not inflicting it on others. We feel separate and create the concept of others. And we deal with the world by creating illusory mental images that form our unique versions of reality. But trying to be separate and holding on to other separate things, including people, leads to more suffering because nothing is permanent and life is a continual cycle of loss and rebirth. Relationships change, people die or move away, objects deteriorate, and so on. Everything is transitory, but because of our fear of being alone and separate, we cling desperately to what we know, to what is familiar, even as we intuitively understand it may not be there tomorrow. After this Buddha mantra, I will give you the Four Noble Truths, Buddhist tradition. On the Modern Spiritual Podcast with Integrity, now let there be light.
Samongate so.
Here is the Four Noble Truths Buddhist Traditions. 1. Life is painful and frustrating. Even if things are okay at the moment, they won't always be great. We all go through painful and frustrating moments. All you have to do is look at the state of the world around you to see this. 2. Suffering has a cause. The cause is our attachment to the familiar, the known. 3. The cause of suffering can be ended by releasing expectations and attachments. We can still have meaningful relationships but without that needy, clingy attachment based on fear of loss and fear of being alone and separate. 4. Meditation, or the practice of mindfulness and awareness, is the way to end suffering. We stop expecting things to be a certain way because we stop focusing on the fantasy of the future. We stop rehashing the past because we are focused on right now. No more self-torture about things we did. What happens? Life becomes very simple. We begin to see things as they really are, not as we fantasize them to be. This brings about incredible inner peace and happiness. That is the Four Noble Truths brought to you. by me, Diva. Now let's get into our mini-series, Mysticism, Chapter, The Voices and the Visions, right here on the Modern Spiritual Podcast, your transformational journey.
Mysticism, a study in nature and development of spiritual consciousness, by Evelyn Underhill. First half of Part 2, Chapter 5, Voices and Visions. We now come to that eternal battleground, the detailed discussion of those abnormal psychic phenomena which appear so persistently in the history of the mystics. That is to say, visions, auditions, automatic script, and those dramatic dialogues between the self and some other factor, the soul, love, reason of the voice of God, which seem sometimes to arise from an exalted and uncontrolled imaginative power, sometimes to attain the proportions of auditory hallucination. Here, moderate persons are like to be hewn in pieces between the two great powers who have long disputed this territory. On the one hand, we have the strangely named rationalists, who feel that they have settled the matter once for all by calling attention to the obvious parallels which exist between the bodily symptoms of acute spiritual stress and the bodily symptoms of certain forms of disease. These considerations, reinforced by those comfortable words, autosuggestion, psychosensorial hallucination, and association neurosis, which do but reintroduce mystery in another and less attractive form, enable them to pity rather than blame the peculiarities of the great contemplatives. French psychology in particular revels in this sort of thing, and would, if it had its way, fill the wards of the Salpêtrière with patients from the Roman calendar. The modern interpreter, says Rufus Jones, finds in the stigmata of St. Francis of Assisi a point of weakness rather than a point of strength, not the marks of a saint, but the marks of emotional and physical abnormality. This is a very moderate statement of the rational position by a writer who is in actual sympathy with certain aspects of mysticism. Yet it may well be doubted whether that flame of living love which could, for one dazzling instant, world body and soul in one, was really a point of weakness in a saint. Whether Blake was quite as mad as some of his interpreters, or the powers of St. Paul and St. Teresa are fully explained on a basis of epilepsy or hysteria. Whether, finally, it is as scientific as it looks to lump together all visions and voices, from Wandering Willie to the Apocalypse of St. John, as examples of unhealthy cerebral activity. As against all this, the intransigent votaries of the supernatural seem determined to play into the hands of their foes. They pin themselves, for no apparent reason, to the objective reality and absolute value of visions, voices, and other experiences which would be classed, in any other department of life, as the harmless results of a vivid imagination, and claim as examples of miraculous interference with natural law, psychic phenomena, which may well be the normal, if rare, methods by which a certain type of intuitive genius actualizes its perceptions of the spiritual world. Materialistic piety of this kind, which would have us believe that St. Anthony of Padua really held the infant Christ in his arms, and that the Holy Ghost truly told the Blessed Angela of Foligno that he loved her better than any other woman in the Velo Spirito, and she knew him more intimately than the apostles themselves, is the best friend the rationalists possess. It turns dreams into miracles and drags down the symbolic visions of genius to the level of pious hallucination. Even the profound and beautiful significance of St. Margaret Mary Alacoque's vision of the Sacred Heart, a pictured expression of one of the deepest intuitions of the human soul, caught up to the contemplation of God's love, has been impaired by the grossly material interpretation which it has been forced to bear. So too the beautiful reveries of Suso, the divine visitations experienced by Francis, Catherine, Teresa, and countless other saints, have been degraded in the course of their supposed elevation to the sphere of supernatural, a process as fatal to their truth and beauty as the stuffing of birds. All this too is done in defiance of the great mystics themselves, who are unanimous in warning their disciples against the danger of attributing too much importance to visions and voices, or accepting them at their face value as messages from God. Nevertheless, these visions and voices are such frequent accompaniments of the mystic life that they cannot be ignored. The messengers of the invisible world knock persistently at the doors of the senses, and not only at those which we refer to hearing and to sight. In other words, supersensual intuitions, the contact between man's finite being and the infinite being in which it is immersed, can express themselves by means of almost any kind of sensory automatism. Strange sweet perfumes and tastes, physical sensations of touch, inward fires, are reported over and over again in connection with such spiritual adventures. Those symbols under which the mystic tends to approach the absolute easily become objectivized and present themselves to the consciousness as parts of experience rather than as modes of interpretation. The knowledge which is obtained in such an approach is wholly transcendental. It consists in an undifferentiated act of the whole consciousness in which under the sphere of love, life draws near to life. Thought, feeling, vision, touch, all are hopelessly inadequate to it, yet all perhaps may hint at that intense perception of which they are the scattered parts. And we shall endlessly be all had in God, says Julian of the Supreme Experience. Him verily seeing and fully feeling, him spiritually hearing, and him delectably smelling and sweetly swallowing. All those so-called hallucinations of the senses which appear in the history of mysticism must, then, be considered soberly, frankly, and without prejudice in the course of our inquiry into the psychology of man's quest of the real. The question for their critics must really be this: do these automatisms, which appear so persistently as a part of the contemplative life, represent merely the dreams and fancies, the ill-digested percepts of the visionary, objectivized and presented to his surface mind in a concrete form? Or are they ever representations, symbolic if you like, of some fact, force or personality, some triumphing spiritual power external to himself? Is the vision only a pictured thought, an activity of the dream imagination? Or is it the violent effort of the self to translate something impressed upon its deeper being, some message received from without, which projects this sharp image and places it before the consciousness? The answer seems to be that the voice or vision may be either of these two things, and that pathology and religion have both been overhasty in their eagerness to snatch at these phenomena for their own purposes. Many, perhaps most, voices do but give the answer which the subject has already suggested to itself. Many, perhaps most, visions are the picturings of dreams and desires. Some are morbid hallucinations, some even symptoms of insanity. All probably borrow their shape, as apart from their content, from the suggestions already present in the mind of the seer. But there are some, experienced by minds of great power and richness, which are crucial for those who have them. These bring wisdom to the simple and ignorant, sudden calm to those who are tormented by doubts. They flood the personality with new light, accompany conversion or the passage from one spiritual state to another, arrive at moments of indecision, bringing with them authoritative commands or counsels, opposed to the inclination of the self, confer a convinced knowledge of some department of the spiritual life before unknown. Such visions, it is clear, belong to another and higher plane of experience from the radiant appearances of Our Lady, the piteous exhibitions of the sufferings of Christ, which swarm in the lives of the saints, and contain no feature which is not traceable to the subject's religious enthusiasms or previous knowledge. These, in the apt phrase of Godfinal, are but images floating on the moving deeps of feeling, not symbolic messages from another plane of consciousness. Some test, then, must be applied, some basis of classification discovered, if we are to distinguish the visions and voices which seem to be symptoms of real transcendental activity from those which are only due to imagination raised to the nth power, to intense reverie, or to psychic illness. That test, I think, must be the same as that which we shall find useful for ecstatic states, namely their life-enhancing quality. Those visions and voices which are the media by which the seeing self truly approaches the absolute, which are the formula under which ontological perceptions are expressed, are found by that self to be sources of helpful energy, charity, and courage. They infuse something new in the way of strength, knowledge, direction, and leave it, physically, mentally, or spiritually, better than they found it. Those which do not owe their inception to the contact of the soul with external reality, in theological language, do not come from God, do not have this effect. At best, they are but the results of the self's turning over of her treasures. At worst, they are the dreams, sometimes the diseased dreams, of an active, rich, but imperfectly controlled subliminal consciousness. Since it is implicit in the makeup of the mystical temperament that the subliminal consciousness should be active and rich, and since the unstable nervous organization which goes with it renders it liable to illness and exhaustion, it is not surprising to find that the visionary experience even of the greatest mystics is mixed in type. Once automatism has established itself in a person, it may as easily become the expression of folly as of wisdom. In the moment when inspiration has ebbed, old forgotten superstitions may take its place. When Julian of Norwich in her illness saw the horrible showing of the fiend red with black freckles, which clutched at her throat with its paws. When St. Teresa was visited by Satan, who left the smell of brimstone behind. Or when she saw him sitting on the top of a breviary and dislodged him by the use of holy water. It is surely reasonable to allow that we are in the presence of visions which tend towards the psychopathic type and which are expressive of little else but an exhaustion and temporary loss of balance on the subject's part, which allowed her intense consciousness of the reality of evil to assume a concrete form. Because we allow this, however, it does not follow that all the visionary experience of such a subject is morbid, any more than Oedipus Tyrannus invalidates Prometheus Unbound, or occasional attacks of dyspepsia invalidate the whole process of nutrition. The perceptive power and creative genius of mystics, as of other great artists, sometimes goes astray. That visions or voices should sometimes be the means by which the soul consciously assimilates the nourishment it needs is conceivable. It is surely also conceivable that by the same means it may present to the surface intelligence things which are productive of unhealthy rather than of healthy reactions. If we would cease once for all to regard visions and voices as objective and be content to see in them forms of symbolic expression, ways in which the subconscious activity of the spiritual self reaches the surface mind, many of the disharmonies noticeable in visionary experience, which have teased the devout and delighted the agnostic, would fade away. Visionary experience is, or at least may be, the outward sign of a real experience. It is a picture which the mind constructs, it is true, from raw materials already at its disposal, as the artist constructs his picture with canvas and paint. But as the artist's paint and canvas picture is the fruit, not merely of contact between brush and canvas, but also of a more vital contact between his creative genius and visible beauty or truth, so too we may see in vision, where the subject is a mystic, the fruit of a more mysterious contact between the visionary and a transcendental beauty or truth. Such a vision, that is to say, is the accident which represents and enshrines a substance unseen, the paint and canvas picture which tries to show the surface consciousness that ineffable sight, that ecstatic perception of good or evil, for neither extreme has the monopoly, to which the deeper, more real soul has attained. The transcendental powers take for this purpose such material as they can find amongst the hoarded beliefs and memories of the self. Hence Plotinus sees the celestial Venus, Suso the eternal wisdom, St. Teresa the humanity of Christ, Blake the strange personages of his prophetic books, others more obviously symbolic objects. St. Ignatius Loyola, for instance, in a moment of lucidity, saw the Most Holy Trinity as it were under the likeness of a triple plectrum, or of three spinet keys, and on another occasion, the Blessed Virgin without distinction of members. Visions and voices, then, may stand in the same relation to the mystic as pictures, poems, and musical compositions stand to the great painter, poet, musician. They are the artistic expressions and creative results, A, of thought, B, of intuition, C, of direct perception. All would be ready to acknowledge how conventional and imperfect of necessity are those transcripts of perceived goodness, truth, and beauty which we owe to artistic genius, how unequal is their relation to reality. But this is not to say that they are valueless or absurd. So too with the mystic, whose proceedings in this respect are closer to those of the artist than is generally acknowledged. In both types, there is a constant and involuntary work of translation going on, by which reality is interpreted in the terms of appearance. In both, a peculiar mental makeup conduces to this result. In artistic subjects, the state of reverie tends easily to a visionary character. Thought becomes pictorial, auditory, or rhythmic as the case may be. Concrete images, balanced harmonies, elusive yet recognizable, surge up mysteriously without the intervention of the will, and place themselves before the mind. Thus the painter really sees his impainted picture. The novelist hears the conversation of his characters. The poet receives his cadences ready-made. The musician listens to a veritable music which pipes to the spirit ditties of no tone. In the mystic, the same type of activity constantly appears. Profound meditation takes a pictorial or dramatic form. Apt symbols which suggest themselves to his imagination become objectivized. The message that he longs for is heard within his mind. Hence those interior voices and imaginary visions which are sometimes, as in Suso, indistinguishable from the ordinary accompaniments of intense artistic activity. Where, however, artistic automatisms spend themselves upon the artist's work, mystical automatisms, in their highest forms, have to do with that transformation of personality which is the essence of the mystic life. They are media by which the self receives spiritual stimulus, is reproved, consoled, encouraged, and guided on its upward way. Moreover, they are frequently coordinated. The voice and the vision go together, corroborate one another, and work out right in relation to the life of the self. Thus, St. Catherine of Siena's mystic marriage was preceded by a voice, which ever said in answer to her prayers, "I will espouse myself thee to myself in faith." And the vision in which that union was consummated was again initiated by a voice saying, "I will this day celebrate solemnly with thee the feast of the betrothal of thy soul, and even as I promised, I will espouse thee to myself in faith." Such automatisms as these, says Delacroix, are by no means scattered and incoherent. They are systematic and progressive. They are governed by an interior aim. They have, above all, a teleological character. They indicate the continuous intervention of a being at once wiser and more powerful than the ordinary character and reason. They are the realization in visual and auditory images of a secret and permanent personality of a superior type to the conscious personality. They are its voice, the exterior projection of its life. They translate to the conscious personality the suggestions of the subconscious. And they permit the continuous penetration of the conscious personality by these deeper activities. They establish a communication between these two planes of existence, and by their imperative nature, they tend to make the inferior subordinate to the superior. Audition. The simplest and, as a rule, the first way in which automatism shows itself is in voices or auditions. The mystic becomes aware of something which speaks to him either clearly or implicitly, giving him abrupt and unexpected orders and encouragements. The reality of his contact with the divine life is thus brought home to him by a device with which the accidents of human intercourse have made him familiar. His subliminal mind, open as it now is to transcendental impressions, at one with the absolute, irradiated by the uncreated light, but still dissociated from the surface intelligence which it is slowly educating, seems to that surface self like another being. Hence its messages are often heard literally as voices, either one, the immediate or inarticulate voice, which the auditive mystic knows so well but finds it so difficult to define. Two, the distinct interior voice, perfectly articulate but recognized as speaking only within the mind. 3. By hallucination, which we have all experienced in dream or reverie, the exterior voice which appears to be speaking externally to the subject and to be heard by the outward ear. This, the traditional classification of auditions, also answers to the three main types of vision. 1. Intellectual. 2. Imaginary. 3. Corporeal. Of these three kinds of voices, the mystics are unanimous in their opinion that the first and least marvelous is by far the best. Belonging indeed to an entirely different plane of consciousness from the uttered interior or exterior word, which few of the great contemplatives are willing to accept without scrutiny as a message from God. The articulate word is inevitably subject to some degree of illusion, even at the best, since so far as it possesses transcendental content, it represents the translation of the simultaneous into successive speech. Let thy good spirit enter my heart, and there be heard without utterance, and without the sound of words speak all truth, says a prayer attributed to St. Ambrose, exactly describing the function of these unmediated or intellectual words. Dynamic messages of this kind, imperative intuitions which elude the containing formula of speech, are invariably attributed by the self to the direct action of the divine. They are indeed their own guarantee, bringing with them an infusion of new knowledge or new life. Their character is less that of messages than of actual invasions from beyond the threshold, transcending succession and conveying all at once fresh truth or certitude. Intellectual words, in fact, are a form of inspiration. Eternal truth bursts in upon the temporarily conditioned human mind. Thus St. Hildegard tells us that each of her great revelations was received in an instant, and St. Bridget of Sweden that the whole substance of her fifth book was given in a flash. Distinct interior words, on the other hand, lack this character of simultaneity, nor are they invariably authoritative for those who hear them. St. Teresa, whose brilliant self-criticisms are our best source of information on mystical auditions, considers that, though they often come from God, they are not due to direct contact with the divine, and agrees with all the great mystics on the need of subjecting them to criticism. She hesitated long before obeying the voice which told her to leave the convent of her incarnation and make the first foundation of her reform. Genuine locutions may, however, be distinguished from those words which result merely from voluntary activity of the imagination, as much by the sense of certitude, peace, and interior joy which they produce, as by the fact that they force themselves upon the attention in spite of its resistance, and bring with them knowledge which was not previously within the field of consciousness. That is to say, they are really automatic presentations of the result of mystic intuition, not mere rearrangements of the constituents of thought. Hence they bring to the surface self new conviction or material, have a positive value for life. Those purely self-created locutions or rearrangements of thoughts which the mind self-recollected forms and fashions within itself, often difficult to distinguish from true automation audition, are called by Philip of the Trinity, St. John of the Cross, and other mystical theologians successive words. They feel it to be of the highest importance that the contemplative should learn to distinguish such hallucinations from real transcendental perceptions presented in auditive form. I am really terrified, says St. John of the Cross with his customary blunt common sense, by what passes among us in these days. Anyone who has barely begun to meditate, if he becomes conscious of words of this kind during his self-recollection, pronounces them forthwith to be the work of God, and, convinced that they are so, goes about proclaiming, God has told me this, or I have had that answer from God. But all is illusion and fancy. Such a one has only been speaking to himself. Besides, the desire for these words and the attention they give to them end by persuading men that all the observations which they address to themselves are the responses of God. These are the words of one who was at once the sanest of saints and the most penetrating of psychologists, words which our modern unruly amateurs of the subconscious might well take to heart. True auditions are usually heard when the mind is in a state of deep absorption without conscious thought, that is to say, at the most favorable of all moments for contact with the transcendental world. They translate into articulate language some aspect of that ineffable apprehension of reality which the contemplative enjoys, crystallize those clairvoyant intuitions, those prophetic hints which surge in on him so soon as he lays himself open to the influence of the suprasensible. Sometimes, however, mystical intuition takes the form of a sudden and ungovernable uprush of knowledge from the deeps of personality. Then, auditions may break in upon the normal activities of the self with startling abruptness. It is in such cases that the objective and uncontrollable character is most sharply felt. However they may appear, they are, says Sister Teresa, very distinctly formed, but by the bodily ear they are not heard. They are, however, much more clearly understood than if they were heard by the ear. It is impossible not to understand them, whatever resistance we may offer. The words formed by the understanding affect nothing, but when our Lord speaks, it is at once word and work. The human locution, i.e. the work of imagination, is as something we cannot well make out, as if we were half asleep. But the divine locution is a voice so clear that not a symbol of its utterance is lost. It may occur too when the understanding and the soul are so troubled and distracted that they cannot form one sentence correctly, and yet grand sentences, perfectly arranged such as the soul in its most recollected state never could have formed, are uttered, and at the first word, as I have said, change it utterly. Sir Teresa's mystic life was governed by voices. Her active career as a foundress was much guided by them. They advised her in small things as in great. Often they interfered with her plans, ran counter to her personal judgment, forbade a foundation on which she was set, or commanded one which appeared imprudent or impossible. They concerned themselves with journeys, with the purchase of houses. They warned her of coming events. As her mystical life matured, Teresa seems to have learned to discriminate those locutions on which action should properly be based. She seldom resisted them, though it constantly happened that the action on which they insisted seemed the height of folly. And though they frequently involved her in hardships and difficulties, she never had cause to regret this reliance upon decrees which she regarded as coming direct from God, and which certainly did emanate from a life greater than her own. So too St. Hildegard, when she prefaced her prophecies and denunciations by, "Thus saith the living light," was not making use of a poetic metaphor. She lived under the direction of a power which was precise and articulate in its communications, and at her peril disobeyed its commands. So far from mere vague intuitions are the distinct interior words which the mystic hears within his mind, that Suso is able to state that the 100 meditations on the Passion thus revealed to him were spoken in German and not in Latin. St. Teresa's own auditions were all of this interior kind, some distinct and some substantial or inarticulate, as her corresponding visions were nearly all of the intellectual or imaginary sort. That is to say, she was not subject to the sensible hallucination. Often, however, the boundary is overpassed, and a locution seems to be heard by the mystic's outward ear, as in the case of those voices which guided the destinies of St. Joan of Arc, or the figure upon the cross which spoke to St. Francis of Assisi. We then have the third form, exterior words, which the mystics, for the most part, regard with suspicion and dislike. Sometimes audition assumes a musical rather than a verbal character, a form of perception which probably corresponds to the temperamental bias of the self, the ordered sweetness of divine harmony striking responsive chords in the music-loving soul. The lives of St. Francis of Assisi, St. Catherine of Siena, and Richard Rohr provide obvious instances of this. But Suso, in whom automatism assumed its richest and most varied forms, has also given in his autobiography some characteristic examples. One day, whilst the servitor was still at rest, he heard within himself a gracious melody by which his heart was greatly moved. And at the moment of the rising of the morning star, a deep, sweet voice sang within him these words, "Stella Maria Maris, Huria Protectit ad Autum." That is to say, "Mary, Star of the Sea, is risen today." And this song which he heard was so spiritual and so sweet that his soul was transported by it, and he too began to sing joyously. And one day, it was in carnival time, the servitor had continued his prayers until the moment when the bugle of the watch announced the dawn. Therefore he said to himself, "Rest for an instant before you salute the shining morning star." And whilst that his senses were at rest, behold, angelic spirits began to sing the fair respond, "Illuminare, illuminare Jerusalem." and this song was echoed with a marvelous sweetness in the deeps of his soul. And when the angels had sung for some time, his soul overflowed with joy, and his feeble body being unable to support such happiness, burning tears escaped from his eyes. Closely connected on the one hand with the phenomena of automatic words, on the other with those of prophecy and inspiration, is the prevalence in mystical literature of revelations which take the form of dialogue, intimate colloquies between divine reality and the soul. The revelations of Julian of Norwich and St. Catherine of Siena, and many of those of the Blessed Angela of Foligno and of the modern mystic Lucy Christine, appear to have been received by them in this way. We seem, as we read them, to be present at veritable outpourings of the divine mind, crystallized into verbal form on their way through the human consciousness. We feel, on the one hand, a oneness with the Absolute on the part of the mystic which has made her really, for the time being, the voice of God. Whilst, on the other, we recognize in her the persistence of the individual, exalted but not yet wholly absorbed in the divine, whose questions, here and there, break in upon the revelation which is mediated by the deeper mind. Duologues of this sort are reported with every appearance of realism and good faith by Suso, Paula, Mechtild of Magdeburg, Angela of Foligno, St. Teresa, and countless other mystics. The third book of the Imitation of Christ contains some conspicuously beautiful examples which may or may not be due to literary artifice. The self, wholly absorbed by the intimate sense of divine companionship, receives its messages in the form of distinct interior words, as of an alien voice, speaking within the mind with such an accent of validity and spontaneity as to leave no room for doubt as to its character. Often, as in Julian's revelations, the discourses of the divine voice, its replies to the eager questions of the self, are illustrated by imaginary visions. Since these dialogues are, on the whole, more commonly experienced in the illuminative than the unitive way, that self-retaining a clear consciousness of its own separateness and recognizing the voice as personal and distinct from its own soul, naturally enters into a communion which has an almost conversational character, replies to questions or asks others in its turn, and in this dramatic style, the content of its intuitions is gradually expressed. We have then an extreme form of that dissociation which we all experience in a slight degree when we argue with ourselves. But in this case, one of the speakers has become the instrument of a power other than itself, and communicates to the mind new wisdom and new life. Peculiar rhythmical language of genuine mystic dialogue of this kind, for often enough, as in Suso's book of the Eternal Wisdom, it is deliberately adopted as a literary device, is an indication of its automatic character. Expression, once it is divorced from the critical action of the surface intelligence, always tends to assume a dithyrambic form. Measure and color, exaltation of language, here take a more important place than the analytic intellect will generally permit. This feature is easily observable in prophecy and in automatic writing. It forms an interesting link with poetry, which, insofar as it is genuine and spontaneous, is largely the result of subliminal activity. Life, which eludes language, can yet, we know not why, be communicated with rhythm, and the mystic fact is above all else the communication of a greater life. Hence we must not take it amiss if the voice of the Absolute, as translated to us by those mystics who are alone capable of hearing it, often seems to adopt the grand manner. We pass from the effort of man's deeper mind to speak truth to his surface intelligence, to the effort of the same mysterious power to show truth, in psychological language, from auditory to visual automatism. Vision, that vaguest of words, has been used by the friends and enemies of the mystics to describe or obscure a wide range of experience, from formless intuition through crude optical hallucination to the voluntary visualizations common to the artistic mind. In it we must include that personal and secret vision which is the lover's glimpse of perfect love, and the great picture seen by clairvoyant prophets acting in their capacity as eyes of the race. Of these, the two main classes of vision, says Denis the Carthusian, the first kind are to be concealed, the second declared. The first are more truly mystic, the second prophetic. But excluding prophetic vision from our inquiry, a sufficient variety of experience remains in the purely mystical class. Since Teresa's fluid and formless apprehension of the Trinity, her concrete visions of Christ, Metzild of Magdeburg's poetic dreams, Suso's sharply pictured allegories, even Blake's soul of a flea, all come under this head. Since no one can know what it is really like to have a vision but the visionaries themselves, it will be interesting to see what they have to say on this subject, and notice the respects in which these self-criticisms agree with the conclusions of psychology. We forget, whilst arguing on these matters, that it is impossible for those who have never heard a voice or seen a vision to discuss these experiences with intelligence, as it is for stay-at-homes to discuss the passions of the battlefield on the material supplied by war correspondents. No second-hand account can truly report the experience of the person whose perceptions or illusions present themselves in this form. We cannot, says Reisiger, remind ourselves too often that the mystic act consists in relations between the absolute and freedom which are incommunicable. We shall never know, for instance, what was the state of consciousness of some citizen of the antique world when he gave himself without reserve to the inspiring suggestions of the sacred fire, or some other image which evoked the infinite. Neither shall we ever know, unless it be our good fortune to attain to it, the secret of that consciousness which is able to apprehend the transcendence in visionary terms. The first thing we notice when we come to this inquiry is that the mystics are all but unanimous in their refusal to attribute importance to any kind of visionary experience. The natural timidity and stern self-criticism with which they approach auditions is here greatly increased, and this, if taken to heart, might well give pause to their more extreme enemies and defenders. If it be so, says Hilton of automatisms in general, that thou see any manner of light or brightness with thy bodily eye or in imagining, other than every man may see, or if thou hear any merry sounding with thy ear, or in thy mouth any sweet sudden savour, other than of kind nature, or any heat in thy breast as it were fire, or any manner delight in any part of thy body, or if a spirit bodily appeareth to thee as it were an angel, for to comfort thee and kiss thee, or any such feeling which thou wast well that it cometh not of thyself, nor of no bodily creature. Be then wary in that time or soon after, and wisely behold the stirrings of thy heart. If thou be stirred because of that liking that thou feelest for to draw out thine heart, from the inward desire of virtues and of ghostly knowing and feeling of God, for to set the sight of thy heart and thine affection, thy delight and thy rest principally therein, meaning that bodily feeling should be a part of heavenly joy and of angels' bliss. This feeling is suspect and of the enemy, and therefore, though it be never so liking and wonderful, refuse it and assent not thereto. Nearly every master of the contemplative life has spoken to the same effect. None perhaps more strong than that stern and virile lover of the invisible, St. John of the Cross, who was relentless in hunting down even the most spiritual illusions, eager to purge mind as well as morals of all taint of the unreal. It often happens, he says, that spiritual men are affected supernaturally by sensible representations and objects. They sometimes see the forms and figures of those of another life, saints or angels, good and evil, or certain extraordinary light and brightness. They hear strange words, sometimes seeing those who utter them and sometimes not. They have a sensible perception at times of most sweet odors without knowing whence they proceed. Still, though all these experiences may happen to the bodily senses in the way of God, we must never delight in them nor encourage them. Yea, rather we must fly from them without seeking to know whether their origin be good or evil. For, inasmuch as they are exterior and physical, the less is the likelihood of their being from God. That which properly and generally comes from God is a purely spiritual communication, wherein there is greater security and profit for the soul than through the senses, wherein there is usually much danger and delusion, because the bodily sense decides upon and judges spiritual things, thinking them to be what itself feels them to be, when in reality they are as different as body and soul, sensuality and reason. Again, in the high state of the union of love, God does not communicate himself to the soul under the disguise of imaginary visions, similitudes, or figures. Neither is there place for such, but mouth to mouth. The soul, therefore, that will ascend to this perfect union with God must be careful not to lean upon imaginary visions, forms, figures, and particular intelligible objects. For these things can never serve as proportionate or proximate means towards so great an end. Yea, rather they are an obstacle in the way, and therefore to be guarded against and rejected. So too, said Teresa, in such matters as these, there is always cause to fear illusion, until we are assured that they truly proceed from the Spirit of God. Therefore, at the beginning, it is always best to resist them. If it is indeed God who is acting, the soul will but progress still more quickly, for the trial will favor her advancement. Vision, then, is recognized by the true contemplative as at best an imperfect, oblique, and untrustworthy method of apprehension. It is ungovernable, capricious, liable to deception, and the greater its accompanying hallucination, the more suspicious it becomes. All, however, distinguish different classes of visionary experience and differentiate sharply between the value of the vision which is felt rather than seen and the true optical hallucination which is perceived exterior to the subject by the physical sight. We may trace in visions as in voices, for these, from the psychologist's point of view, are strictly parallel phenomena. A progressive externalization on the self's part of those concepts or intuitions which form the basis of all automatic states. Three main groups have been distinguished by the mystics and illustrated again and again from their experiences. These are 1. Intellectual, 2. Imaginary, and 3. Corporeal vision, answering to 1. Substantial or inarticulate, 2. Interior and distinct, 3. Exterior words. With the first two, we must now concern ourselves. As to corporeal vision, it has few peculiarities of interest to the student of pure mysticism. Like the exterior word, it is little else than a more or less uncontrolled externalization of inward memories, thoughts, or intuitions, even of some pious picture which has become imprinted on the mind, which may in some subjects attain the dimensions of true sensorial hallucination. End of first half of part 2, chapter 5.